Bob Dylan once sang, "You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows." That's especially true in Mr. Dylan's home state of Minnesota and in the neighboring Dakotas, where the wind chill factor can make an average winter's day downright dangerous, which may explain why the National Weather Service in the region will now issue extreme cold warnings instead of wind chill warnings. We're joined by the fittingly named Greg Gust. He's the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service for eastern North Dakota and northwestern Minnesota. Welcome to the program, Mr. Gust.
Well, thank you very much, Guy.
You have said this is merely wind chill with a different name. Are the words wind chill just not scary enough to folks?
Well, the wind chill itself has got a fair amount of fame and notoriety over the years. But one of the problems with it is, when the wind drops off, is it still a problem? Prior to this, if the wind was dropping off, well, we stopped the warning. What if it's really darn cold out there? So that's what we're trying to get at, is the wind may be dropping off, but typically in those situations, the actual temperature has now become that dangerous.
All right, so give us a sense of what your standard for issuing an extreme cold alert will be. What will have to happen outside?
Well, I'll give you an example that today I rode my bicycle into work. It was 22 degrees Fahrenheit outside. The 8-mile-an-hour wind gave a wind chill of about 12 degrees Fahrenheit. But I'm riding about 8 to 10 miles an hour, so now I'm pushing the wind chill to the single digits.
Wow.
That's today. That's early to middle part of November.
You're a tough dude, man.
Well, in another week or two, our average high temperature will be below freezing. Mm. And in a month, that average high temperature will be in the teens.
Ouch.
So now the low temperatures and the possibility for getting below zero and much below zero crop up. The scenario would likely be having something like a winter storm occurring and you have wind. So now the temperature is dropping, 10 below zero, 20 below zero. At 20 below zero and with a 15-mile-an-hour wind, you are going to start having wind chill issues where you're at minus 40, minus 45 on a wind chill. So at that point, we normally would have had a wind chill warning in effect. As that storm system moves away and the cold air continues to drain in, the wind will drop off. But now under clear skies and light wind conditions, the actual temperature itself starts to drop into that minus 30, minus 40 degree range. And so quite often, the wind chill warning would expire, but now the actual air temperature would be that cold.
When you issue the extreme cold warning, what should people be doing?
Well, it's just like with a wind chill warning, they should be ensuring that they are properly dressed for it. School districts don't have outside recess at those type of temperatures.
They don't have outside recess when it's minus 40?
Yeah, I think they consider that perhaps the children should stay indoors at those rates.
Okay, this is going to be, I understand, this is a little bit of a test because people have gotten used to this over the years. So what if there's a rebellion and people say, you know, we want the wind chill warnings back?
Well, it is an experiment, so clearly we still have the wind chill warning in our quiver. But it's, you know, we're working with this slowly. Last year it was a little test. Now it's a bigger test.
But I wonder whether you're a little bit nervous about this. I mean, wind chill factor is a pretty big brand name. Like New Coke or any other new brand comes out, people are not always comfortable with those changes.
Well, I don't know. Do you think extreme cold is sexy enough to get into the vernacular? We think it has meaning here, and we're testing that to see if it has enough meaning to warrant the change.
Well, Greg Gust, thank you so much.
You are welcome, Guy. It's been a pleasure.
That's meteorologist Greg Gust of the National Weather Service in Grand Forks, North Dakota, talking about the experiment to no longer issue wind chill warnings.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A classic work of children's literature is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, The Phantom Tollbooth by Norton Juster. To mark the occasion, Juster recorded this essay for us, explaining why he still identifies with his main character, a bored little boy who finds himself on a great adventure.
There was once a boy named Milo who didn't know what to do with himself. Not just sometimes, but always. When he was in school, he longed to be out, and when he was out, he longed to be in. Nothing really interested him, least of all the things that should have. The Phantom Tollbooth was the first book I had ever written, and my first collaboration with the cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer. Like most good things that have happened in my life, the book came about because I was trying to avoid doing something else. It was 1958, and after 3 years in the Navy, I returned to New York City to work as an architect. I had also received a grant to write a book on cities for children. I started it with great energy and enthusiasm, until I found myself waist-deep in stacks of 3x5 note cards, exhausted and dispirited. This is not what I wanted to do. In order to stop thinking about cities, I had to start thinking about something else. I had been an odd child, quiet, introverted, and moody. When I grew up, I still felt like that puzzled kid, disconnected, disinterested, and confused. There was no rhyme or reason in that kid's life. My thoughts began to focus more and more on him. I began writing about his childhood, which was really mine. Coming home from school one day, Milo finds an unexpected gift, a highway toll booth, a map, and directions to a place called the Lands Beyond. So off he goes on his journey of discovery. He travels to Dictionopolis, the kingdom of words, to Digitopolis, the land of numbers, goes astray by jumping to the island of conclusions, and at last rescues the two princesses, Rhyme and Reason, from the castle in the air. Not everyone in the publishing world of the 1960s embraced the Phantom Tollbooth. Many said that it was not a children's book. The vocabulary was much too difficult, and the ideas were beyond kids. To top it off, they claimed fantasy was bad for children because it disoriented them, and that no child should ever have to confront anything that he or she didn't already know. But my feeling was that there is no such thing as a difficult word. There are only words you don't know yet, the kind of liberating words that Milo encounters on his adventure. Today's world of texting and tweeting is quite a different place, but children are still the same as they've always been. Well, maybe one thing has changed. As many states eliminate tolls on highways, some children may never encounter a real toll booth. Luckily, there are other routes to the lands beyond, and it is possible to seek them and fun to try.
Norton Juster is the author of The Phantom Tollbooth, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. He and illustrator Jules Pfeiffer will join us later this month for NPR's Backseat Book Club. Young listeners can read the book and then email questions for Juster and Pfeiffer to backseatbookclub@npr.org.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We are going to end the program today by talking fashion. No apology. It's a hobby for many people, and for others, dare we say it, a way of life. In a few minutes, we'll visit with Kevin Hall. He's dressed First Lady Michelle Obama and A-list Hollywood stars. We want to ask him about his rise to the top of the fashion world, one of the few African Americans in those ranks, and maybe a word or two about his new bridal collection. But first, we take a look at high fashion in the Arab world. Renowned Iraqi designer Hana Sadek is known for her intricate designs with elements like embroidery and even calligraphy drawn from Arab culture. She says she hopes to create an elegant look tailored for the modern Arab woman. She's designed dresses for members of the royal families of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and other Gulf states. But now, for the first time, she's bringing her distinctive style to the U.S. Tonight, she's wrapping up her first U.S. tour at the Lincoln Theater in Washington, D.C., at an event called Turath, a celebration of Arab culture in America. And Hana Sadek joins us now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you to give me this opportunity to explain about our heritage.
Which is what Tirath means, correct? It means heritage.
Tirath in Arabic, it means heritage, yes.
Okay. Well, yeah. Wonderful. Thank you for coming. Now, when people think of American fashion, I think that they think, you know, casual. I think when people think of European fashion, perhaps they have a sense of maybe tight tailoring and things of that sort. When you think of Arab fashion, what do you think of?
I want to just explain very clearly that when we speak about fashion, it means for inside the community of Arabic families, because the best they wear it for the people they love. It means husband, family, or friends. They don't wear their best clothes for people they don't know in the street. So this is the difference between two cultures, the Western and Eastern culture.
I see your point, because I think for many Americans, their image of Arab women and how they attire themselves, they're perhaps used to seeing public figures wearing what we would call Western attire, you know, mm-hmm. the skirt, suit, and a dress. But if they see women dressed in a traditional way, many times they see them covered. So they don't have a sense of what else is possible.
What's going on.
What's going on. And so you're saying that really showing your best is for the home.
It's for people they know. And when I went to the West, they think that our dresses, because they are long and long sleeves, it's for traditional conservative women, which is not true. Because the long sleeves and long dress in our culture means that the woman, she is pampered and it means she is served.
Oh, so she's wearing long sleeves because she's not doing dishes.
She's not doing dishes. She's not working in the farm or gardening.
How did you get bitten by the fashion bug? How did you fall in love with fashion?
I started as a painter. I was famous in Iraq, in Baghdad. You know, Baghdad was a beautiful city with the river and a nice sky and the palm trees. And these were inspiring anybody. And then I left Baghdad. I studied in Paris about painting and ceramic and whatever connected with art. But I had nostalgia for our heritage. And I remember my grandmother, she was using all these long, beautiful dresses. And when she entered, she was much more feminine than any other Western dresses. These dresses gives the woman grandiose, yani, very, very chic and classy. Everybody looked at her when she entered. And I thought, my God, what am I doing here? I have to teach the woman how to be feminine again and sensual as they were before.
Now, your styles, I've seen both traditional flowing styles that some might associate with more conservative wear, but I've also seen more figure-revealing styles that hug close to the body. Do you sell some pieces or show some pieces in some parts of the world but not others, or do you bring your whole collection wherever you go?
No, it's the same collection. This collection, it's about love. All pieces is signed with the name of love. You know, love in Arabic, it's not like in English one or two words. I found more than 70 words for love in Arabic. And we use it in our poetry and in our songs. So I use this collection like peace against violence. All these people, they talk a lot of violence in the world. So I went back to the classic way how we see love. And through the fashion, you can love her fashion, her dress, but you admire the woman, and then you forget about her dress immediately.
Finally, and thank you for coming, by the way. Before we let you go, is it your hope that women who are not of Middle Eastern heritage will wear your designs?
I'm working on the Arabic woman first. They have to respect their heritage so the others, they respect them. Second, why not? Red carpet, I see a lot of actress, but it's all the same. It's open shoulders, open sleeves, open. We see a lot of legs, but it's not sensual, it's not feminine. It's not because you show your breast it's feminine. This is what I want to show them. So you can be covered, but also very, very sexy and feminine.
So what will you be wearing tonight?
I'm wearing turquoise because Iraqi color of Babylon gate was turquoise, ceramic turquoise. And I'm always proud to be Iraqi also.
Hana Sadek is an Iraqi fashion designer. She is based in Jordan. She's known in Italy as the ambassador of Arabic fashion. She wraps up her first U.S. tour tonight at the event Tadrath, which is held at the historic Lincoln Theater in Washington, D.C. Hana Sadek, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
If you'd like to see some of Hana Sadek's designs, go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. In the world according to fantasy writer Andy Wilson, kids become caretakers of the world's secrets. A snake named Patricia is actually a necklace designed to protect you from harm, and death is not always a definite end. Andy Wilson's new novel for young adults is The Dragon's Tooth, and it's the first in a series of stories he calls The Ashtown Burials. Andy Wilson is with us here in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thanks a bunch.
Tell us the premise of this story.
Well, the premise is that there are two very American kids who live in a roadside motel in Wisconsin who get caught up sort of Treasure Island style in the intrigues around an old coot named Billy Bones, who shows up to the motel, gives them a key ring, and then dies in a massive conflagration and fight. And they get swept up in an order of explorers. And the real premise there was that Brendan the Navigator, the Irish monk from way back when, mm-hmm. sailed in a little leather boat across the ocean to North America and up the Hudson and eventually into the Great Lakes, and founded the outer outpost of his order of explorers, the Order of Brendan.
A place called Ashtown.
A place called Ashtown.
Tell me about Ashtown.
Ashtown is this large campus estate that was originally a penal colony. You know, this was the ends of the earth, and it's in Wisconsin. But at the time, you know, back in the 500s, 600s, this was as far as you could go. But now, as millennia have trickled past, you have, you know, the stronghold of this order of explorers stuck in Wisconsin, which is where these kids get drawn in.
And indeed, it turns out that the secrets of the world are held in Wisconsin.
Yeah, absolutely. And didn't we all know that already?
Yeah. The two main protagonists, the kids, are Cyrus, he's 12, and his sister Antigone, she's 13. Initially, we don't know what happened to their parents, but we know they're not around. They eventually find out that their dad is not quite who they thought he was.
Yeah, their father was a member of this Order of Explorers and became angry with it because they prohibited him from marrying their mother. So he was expelled from the Order. So they have historically a very tenuous relationship with the Order of Explorers they're coming into. Their dad was a great explorer. They never knew that. They just knew him as the peaceful, normal pops that
and,
they always had.
And at that age, they are introduced to this world that beforehand had no idea existed.
Yeah, absolutely. So they get swept up in it. And at first, it's just run for your life. And then they have to collect themselves and really figure out why it is that people are chasing them for this key ring that Billy Bones gave them with the dragon's tooth on it and you know, start putting together their own plan.
We shouldn't give away too much of the story, of course. It's an amazing tale. But throughout the book, we bounce back and forth between reality and fantasy. And this is very deliberate. I mean, your book is really rooted in reality, in the real world.
Absolutely. And I think that's probably one of the two biggest things I want to do. I want to write fantasy that really connects to American kids where American kids are. Growing up, I loved the Narnia Chronicles. Now I can look at Harry Potter and, you know, I can see my kids loving Harry Potter. But the assumption that I had growing up was you had to be in England if you wanted to have a magical adventure.
Right.
And I want to connect global fantasy, global mythology to Americana, roadside diners, truck stops, waffle irons, you know, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm doing. That's one part. The other part is that this world is so taken for granted by kids and by adults even more so. But it's really easy to read Narnia, to read Lord of the Rings, and then to end to have this bad aftertaste. You know, I remember that taste as a kid, being sort of in love with this story, and then it stops, and I can never go there.
Yeah.
I can never see Narnia, and I can never be magical. In this story, I really want to connect kids to the fantasy of here. This place is fantastic. This place is amazing. And you can actually connect to it when you're done. So no matter how hard you try after you read Harry Potter, you can get a wand, you can try to cast spells, it's not going to happen. In this Order of Explorers, if you become a super fan and you really want to be like these kids, you actually can. You can go learn Latin. You can go study what they study, and you can physically train, and you can explore this world because this is the crazy place. You know, I tell school kids we are on a ball of rock flying at Mach 86 around a ball of fire in the sky. You know, we're just whipping around this thing.
Right.
And if I told Frodo how I got here on an airplane and described it for him, he would not think this was an unmagical world. He had to fly on an eagle.
Right.
It's like, I've got this steel machine that hurtles through the sky. So kids can really awaken to the wonder of here and the wonder of now, and I think that's really important.
And all you really need to do is go to Wisconsin.
Yeah, exactly.
Reading this book, I obviously it's hard not to notice there is a lot of violence.
Sure.
A lot of guns, a lot of dying.
Yeah.
That is real. That is not fantasy violence.
Yeah, this goes back to the whole real world versus escapism question. If I read Harry Potter, am I really ever scared that Voldemort's going to take over?
Mm.
Not really. With this one, I really actually base the evils on real evils too. So my main villain is the son of an actual eugenicist who actually pioneered mandatory sterilization laws. This is the kind of thing that has actually happened.
Mm.
And these are things I want kids inspired to explore and resist and overcome.
Are there certain tropes, fantasy tropes, that you wanted to stay away from in Dragon's Tooth?
I wanted my kids to never discover that they were magical, to never become magical, to the entire series always be kids who work hard to overcome obstacles, kids who train, kids who are educated, and more so as the series progresses.
Right. Obviously, they go to Ashtown, and that's where they learn how to do these things.
But even there, it's not a school. The impetus is entirely on them.
Yeah.
You show up, and what are you going to do to advance? What are you going to do? You know, like, nobody's going to make you learn Latin. You know, what are you going to do to stick around here? And I wanted to closely connect this one to real kids. You know, kids who read this and can understand Cyrus Smith throws his homework in the creek behind the motel. He's this very normal American boy, and he's the kind of guy who can actually become a hero in this fantasy world.
And, of course, we will find out what happens to Cyrus and Antigone and Dan. This is the first in a series. Presumably you've got one, two, three, four more mapped out in your mind. What is it like writing the beginning of something that, you know, you may be working on for many, many books to come, many years to come?
Well, I think that I was scared in advance, because I had sold this to Random House. I had pitched them this project. And the thing that was that worried me the most was that I would have to hang out in this place with these characters for a minimum of 5 years.
Minimum.
So I was really invested up front in making sure I liked these people. These were real humans I wanted to spend a lot of time with. This was a world I really wanted to explore. And I'm real excited with how it came out, because it's this world, and I do want to explore this place.
So you know what happens.
I do, yes.
You know what happens all the way until the end.
Yes.
I hope you have protection, because people may try to kidnap you and get that information.
Yeah, we'll see. I could pull a J.K. Rowling and hold characters hostage.
Well, Andy Wilson, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
That's writer Andy Wilson. His new fantasy novel for young adults is called The Dragon's Tooth. Today, News Corp executive James Murdoch faced a new round of hostile questions. For the second time, he appeared before British lawmakers to answer for his actions in the phone hacking scandal now roiling his company. News Corp chairman Rupert Murdoch has groomed his son James to succeed him. But as NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik reports now, the younger Murdoch had a tough time dispelling doubts about his credibility.
James Murdoch tried to strike a very delicate balance between contrition and confidence today while staying away from accepting any personal responsibility. He said News Corp had wrongly lashed out at the handful of journalists who had exposed wrongdoing at its tabloid News of the World.
If there was a mistake, I think, or a shift that we need to focus on, it was the tendency for a period of time to react to criticism or allegations as hostile or motivated commercially or politically.
No one accuses Murdoch of approving the illegal phone hacking or police bribery at the heart of the scandal. He became chairman of News Corp's British wing in December 2007, after those activities are said to have stopped. But his troubles are found in the classic questions surrounding cover-ups. What did he know, and when did he know it? Company officials had declared the criminal activity was limited to a single rogue reporter and a sole investigator focused on the royal family. This summer, Murdoch told MPs he didn't learn such practices were widespread until last year. But the paper's former top lawyer and top editor directly contradict him. They say they told Murdoch back in 2008 of a smoking gun email that proved hacking was rife. They told him of it, they said, in order to win his approval for a big payoff to keep a completely different victim of phone hacking out of public view. MP Tom Watson has been a leading critic.
Mr. Murdoch, let me just ask you again. Did you mislead this committee in your original testimony?
No, I did not.
So if you didn't, who did?
Murdoch pointed to former attorney Tom Crone and former editor Colin Myler and said they should have told him of any criminal acts. New circumstantial evidence supports the idea Murdoch was told, but no hard proof emerged today. Watson asked Murdoch if he knew the mafia term omerta, helpfully defining it as a secret bond among ruthless people who use intimidation, corruption, and criminality to pursue their aims.
Would you agree with me that this is an accurate description of News International in the UK?
Absolutely not. I think that's offensive and it's not true.
Watson listed various allegations against News Corp in the UK, many of them substantiated.
Mr. Murdoch, you must be the first mafia boss in history who didn't know he was running a criminal enterprise.
New revelations undermine Murdoch's position further. The company had hoped to quarantine the scandal by closing the News of the World. Yet, a senior reporter for the sister tabloid The Sun has now been arrested on suspicion of bribing police. Murdoch also now concedes his company paid private investigators to follow MP Tom Watson in 2009. And PIs were paid to follow the two leading attorneys for phone hacking victims for more than a year, only ending in May. A hardball effort to dig up damaging material on the lawyers and their children.
I want to say for the record, it is appalling. It is something I would never condone, and the company should never condone. And it was shocking when I found it out, and it's just unacceptable.
Unlike the original hacking and bribery, these developments occurred on Murdoch's watch. MP Paul Farrelly echoed his colleagues' questions about Murdoch's competence, pointing to his denials even after a major expose in the Guardian newspaper.
So even at that stage, in the middle of 2009, as the executive chairman of News International, you are possibly the only person in London who still thinks that there's one rogue reporter and one private detective.
Later this month, shareholders in the British broadcasting giant BSkyB will decide whether Murdoch should continue as non-executive chairman. News Corp owns nearly 40% of that company's stock, but its corporate directors could push him out even if he survives the vote. MPs landed no knockout blow today, but Murdoch did little to improve his own credibility or his chances of running the company. David Folkenflik, NPR News, London.
And now we'd like to take another walk down the runway with a designer for America's A-List. If you've watched the Emmys and Academy Awards, then you've probably seen those glamorous haute couture gowns of Kevin Hall. He's known for dressing fashion stars like Vanessa Williams, Salma Hayek, Celine Dion, and Michelle Obama. His work has earned him multiple awards. He was named the Great American Designer by the NAACP in 1989 and the Style Maker of the Year by Life and Style magazine in 2005. He was also among the handful of top African-American designers in the country. Kevin Hall grew up in Detroit in the 1960s and later based his company in Los Angeles. Tomorrow, he'll be in Washington, D.C. to show off his 2012 bridal and ready-to-wear collections. So we thought this was a good time to catch up with him as well. Kevin Hall, welcome. Thanks for joining us as well.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me here.
Now, I understand that you knew from a very young age that you wanted to be a fashion designer. Can you just take us back to those days and tell us how you got bitten by the fashion bug?
You know, I was about 7 years old, And I would sit in front of the television or in front of watching old movies and that kind of thing with pen and paper in hand, and I would sketch and pretend to be redesigning the costumes of whomever, whatever celebrity or star that I saw on TV.
Were you supported in that, or was that something that you had to fight your way through?
No, I was very much supported. My parents were fantastic. I mean, you know, they gave me all kinds of art books and materials and sketch pads and magazines, and they encouraged it. I mean, you know, they pushed me outside to play as well. But, you know, any time that I, you know, had an opportunity, I was, you know, with my pen and paper in hand.
You launched Kevin Hall Couture in Los Angeles in 1982. But then a decade later, you worked to try to revive the legendary House of Halston in New York. Now, what
yes.
was that experience like? In a way, it's kind of like a somebody trying to, take on a, I'm thinking the an analogy of somebody taking on a legendary role by a legendary actor. And people are
right.
always skeptical and always critical. What was
yeah.
that like?
People were skeptical. I mean, you know, I was not the New York insider. You know, I was coming from Los Angeles, although I had a successful ready-to-wear company at the time. People was like, you know, who's this guy? And, you know, it was a thrilling time for me. I was able to go in there and, you know, be the design and creative director. And actually, I commuted between New York and Los Angeles. And, you know, we were picked up by top retailers, you know, Neiman Marcus, Saks Fifth Avenue, and worn by a coterie of celebrities around the world.
And now, of course, your work is being worn by Michelle Obama, the First Lady.
Yes.
What does that mean to have a First Lady wear one of your pieces? Does that have an immediate impact?
It absolutely does. I mean, you know, it just speaks volumes because, you know, the First Lady has access to the most beautiful clothes from any American designer. And then when she would select something for me, it just was exciting and thrilling, you know, for me, for the house.
Now, I have to ask you, though, it's a kind of a sticky question, though, that there are some who are critical that her inaugural gown was not designed by an African-American designer. And it's interesting, given that the African-Americans have such a strong presence in the history of American fashion.
Right.
But there are not as many names who are kind of at the top as you are. Were you personally hurt or upset that she did not choose an African-American to design her inaugural gown or any part of her inaugural ensemble?
I was thrilled that she turned out looking as lovely as she did. I would have loved to have had that opportunity. I was honestly, you know, a bit disappointed that I didn't get that call. But, you know, I was excited when I did finally get a chance to dress her. She's a very beautiful woman.
What was the occasion? What have you dressed her for?
She wore a wonderful tie front polka dot simple dress of mine to a speech that she gave in the Washington area.
Did you know in advance that she had chosen one of your pieces, or did you find out when you saw it?
I knew that she'd chosen the dress and that she owned the dress, but I did not know, you know, at which point she was going to wear it. So I found out, you know, like the rest of the world, when she, you know, turned out for that speech looking amazing. We basically just, we saw it on the internet.
Did you jump up and down?
Up and down, yeah.
You had a happy dance.
We did. Singing and shouting.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with Kevin Hall. He's known for dressing some of the hottest celebrities in Hollywood, as well as First Lady Michelle Obama and A-listers around the country. And he's heading to Washington to show his 2012 bridal and ready-to-wear collection. So we thought this was a good chance to touch base with him. I did want to ask you about the fact that many Americans are struggling financially, and unemployment has hit African Americans particularly hard. And I know that that's not exclusively your customer base, that you dress people of all backgrounds who can afford your work. But I'm wondering whether the country's economic challenges affect the way you think of your work right now or affect your designs.
Yeah, it absolutely does, because, you know, everybody is being very price conscious and they're not able to buy as much as they used to buy, or maybe they're not buying, you know, they really cut back and they're not buying at all. So, you know, in my approach to that is to try to find fabrics and things that are, you know, a better price point where they still have a look of luxury, but perhaps they are, you know, maybe not 100% silk, or maybe there's a silk blend, or maybe I'll find, you know, some interesting jersey fabrics or something that I hadn't even considered before, but, you know, still stays within the look and within the aesthetic of the brand.
Can I ask you this other question, though? And I just want to show you that I have asked other designers of other backgrounds this question when I've had an opportunity to speak with them. There are those who, maybe we can sort of loop it back to the First Lady, Michelle Obama. On the one hand, people are very appreciative, particularly people in the American fashion industry are very appreciative that she likes fashion, that she wears it well, that she's interested in a broad range of designs and designers. I mean, she does it all from the haute couture to the J. Crew and Target, right. Even from what we're told. So on the one hand, some people are very appreciative of that. On the other hand, whenever we do a conversation like this, someone inevitably will say, this is trivial, this is unimportant, why are you talking about that nonsense, you know, at a time like this when, you know, we have people suffering? So for people who do question why it matters, why does fashion matter, what do you say?
Well, fashion matters because there is, you know, it's a huge industry in California, and actually, you know, throughout our country, a huge industry. In California, we do more manufacturing and production than any other state. New York certainly is a capital as well. You have to think about the mills that are making fabrics. You think about the sewers, the people that are, you know, sitting down stitching the clothing. There's still a lot of industry and a lot of manufacturing that's done here, and it's an important part of our economy.
And why bridal?
Bridal, you know, I did a dress for Tia Mowry. She had asked me to do her wedding gown. And from that, you know, from the press that we got from that and from also other of my clients, their daughters asking me to do their gowns, I thought I'm going to actually roll out a full-blown bridal collection. And I find that girls don't really want to look like, you know, cupcakes anymore or like, you know, princesses. They want to look like movie stars. And so that's what we do. We have taken the red carpet aesthetic and we're giving it to the white carpet. So the girls are looking, you know, beautiful and glamorous and really like Hollywood.
And finally, before we let you go, do you have any advice for people who are listening to our conversation and who would like to follow in your footsteps?
In terms of being a designer, you must, you know, study at a school or study as an apprentice so that you really get your hands into the design process. You should, you know, immerse yourself in books and magazines and the museums and go to the stores and shop and look at all kinds of clothing and then pick something that really speaks to you and what you love to do and then follow that dream.
What other dreams do you have?
We are going to be launching some secondary collections that are going to be even more affordable so that...
Oh, you mean, you know, for me is what you're saying.
We embrace everyone.
Okay.
So we want to, you know,
I don't
have
know how I feel about being called a secondary collection. Like, can we come up with something else?
I'm sure you can do the first collection as well.
But, I don't know. Two kids to send to college. But
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I hear you. But we are going to be doing a lot of different collections that will address the needs of, you know, beautiful women around the world.
Is there any piece of clothing that just makes you crazy? You just think, oh, no, I just can't bear it. Anything?
Nothing particularly that I have to buy, but one thing that I am not a fan of are leggings. I don't think everybody needs to be in a legging. That's the one thing that bugs me.
Okay, duly noted. Kevin Hall is an award-winning fashion designer. He was kind enough to join us from our studios in Culver City, California. Tomorrow, he'll be in Washington, D.C. to show off his 2012 bridal and ready-to-wear collections. We were able to catch up with him. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And if you'd like to see some photos of Kevin Hall's latest designs, we will have a few of them posted on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More. And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Freddie Boswell, Bracton Booker, Bridget DeShagas, Arjun Hutchins, Eamon Malone, Sanaj Meshkinpour, Emily Oxenschlager, Amitha Parasher, and Amy Ta. Our intern is Malik Washington. Our director is Monica Evstatieva. Our editors are Alicia Montgomery and Ahmad Omar. They had a hand this week from Lori Grant. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. The technical director is Brian Jarbo. He had a hand this week from Neil Tevold. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. The executive producer is Tashima Walker. And to tell us more, please go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Tell Me More NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow. We'll be right back.